Listen local. Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Museum at Bethel Woods preserving firsthand accounts of the 1969 Woodstock Festival through their oral history initiative. They have an upcoming site, a stop at the original site of the festival, now known as Bethel Woods. It's this weekend. We speak with Julia Fell from the museum, and we'll also hear from some folks who they've recorded so far, including one attendee who was 8 at the time. Science Cabaret, a night of neuroscience lectures and performance at Farm Arts Collective, is coming up Saturday. Joe Johnson tells us about the mind-bending evening between the disciplines of science and art, and plein air painters and other artists gathering Saturday in an effort to celebrate and save the Skinner's Falls Bridge. We'll learn more, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks open higher this morning after a better-than-expected inflation report. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 300 points in early trading.
Consumer prices rose less than forecasters had expected last month. A report from the Labor Department this morning shows annual inflation was 3.3% in May, a slightly smaller increase than the month before. A drop in gasoline prices helped keep the cost of living in check between April and May, partially offsetting a rise in rent and restaurant prices. Airfares and new car prices were also down during the month, while grocery prices were flat. Investors are hoping that slowdown in inflation will allow the Federal Reserve to start cutting interest rates later this year. Fed policymakers are meeting in Washington today and will provide an updated forecast this afternoon of where they think interest rates are headed. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Mediators from Egypt and Qatar have been studying Hamas's response to a three-phase ceasefire plan for Gaza. Today in Qatar, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Hamas proposed numerous changes to the plan. He says some of them are workable and some are not. He says there is work ahead to close the peace deal. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi has more from Tel Aviv.
An Israeli official briefed on Hamas's response tells NPR that it is, quote, not according to Israel's proposal, that Hamas wants an end to the war and that Israel will not agree to that. Israel has maintained that its ultimate goal is to destroy Hamas. The official remained anonymous because Israel is not commenting publicly on the matter. The proposed deal outlines a full ceasefire for 6 weeks, which President Biden said has the potential to become permanent. Families of Israeli hostages held in Gaza by Hamas are pressuring Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accept the deal. But if he does, far-right members of his government who don't want the war to end say they will topple the government. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Four states held primary elections yesterday: Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina. There was a special election for a congressional district in Ohio. In Nevada, retired Army Captain Sam Brown won the Republican Senate primary. He'll now face incumbent Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen. Nevada Public Radio's Paul Boger reports many expect this to be among the country's most competitive contests this fall.
Brown, a Purple Heart recipient who was severely burned by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan in 2008, has received endorsements from notable GOP groups, including the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and most recently, former President Donald Trump. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said Brown has, quote, the pure grit and courage to take on enemies, both foreign and domestic. Nevada is seen as a key battleground state in this election, and a GOP victory could go a long way to overhaul the Democrats' 51-49-seat majority in the Senate. For NPR News, I'm Paul Boger in Reno.
On Wall Street, the Dow's now up 270 points. This is NPR. It's really raining this morning in southern Florida. The National Weather Service says up to 9 inches of rain may fall there by tonight. Some areas could get even more rain than that. The Federal Aviation Administration says there are ground stops this hour at Miami International Airport and at nearby Fort Lauderdale. The FAA says thunderstorms have forced a halt to the flights. The Virginia NAACP is taking legal action against a school board that wants to put the names of Confederate generals back on its schools, this after removing them in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. NPR's Kristen Wright reports.
The Virginia NAACP is bringing the federal lawsuit on behalf of several students who attend or will attend Mountain View High School and Honey Run Elementary in Quicksburg. The Shenandoah County School Board recently voted to change the names back to Stonewall Jackson and Ashby Lee. Members said the 2020 board made its decision hastily with little community input. The civil rights suit claims the Confederate names embrace pro-slavery and white supremacist views in school and send a discriminatory and harmful message of Black inferiority. The Virginia NAACP alleges the psychological, emotional, and academic harm of Black students. The plaintiffs are seeking the removal of Confederate names and mascots for good. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
A federal judge has overturned a Florida law that bans gender-affirming care for transgender children. The judge says the Florida law is discriminatory and unconstitutional. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's office says it will appeal. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The museum at Bethel Woods is preserving firsthand accounts of the 1969 Woodstock Festival through an oral history initiative. We've told you a little bit about it. Currently, the initiative is embarking on its second cross-country road trip to find attendees with an upcoming stop, well, right here at Bethel Woods, the site of the original festival. Here with more details is Julia Fell from the museum at Bethel Woods. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here, for giving us an update on the Oral History Initiative. I mentioned that this is your second cross-country road trip you're embarking on to find the attendees at that festival. How's it going so far?
It's going fantastically. We have already collected almost 300 stories this year, which is just an incredible number to be achieving. We're hoping to actually reach 500 by the end of this year. And that would bring us to a total of about 1,200 in the collection altogether.
That's amazing. And that is still only about 1% of the people who were actually at the festival, right? So you're still trying to get as many as you can, but that's still the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it's sort of a drop in the bucket if you think about how many people were actually at Woodstock. But it is one of the larger oral history projects that I'm aware of. And yeah, it's just like a ball rolling downhill. We're very, very proud of the progress we've made.
Yeah. I mentioned you're going to be at the museum at Bethel Woods, site of the original concert, this weekend, the 14th through the 16th. Talk about the importance of being at the site and the people that you hope to attract there.
Yeah, I mean, our base of operations is at the site always. We're very grounded in being on the actual landscape and historic property. We welcome people to the museum to share their oral histories all the time, but doing a very targeted, specific pop-up program, we're really hoping to attract some of those local people who maybe haven't approached us before, who are in the area and have just never really felt like it was the right time. And now is definitely the time. We're going to be there all weekend, specifically on Saturday, June 15th. We're going to have all day available for the oral histories, and we hope you will drop in and share what you know about Woodstock.
And
why it matters.
People have to have an appointment. Would you prefer that they're filling out the information on the website?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways to get in touch with us, ideally. You can email us at oralhistory@bethelwoodscenter.org. That's oral, O-R-A-L, history@bethelwoodscenter.org. Or you can go to our website, which is www.bethelwoodscenter.org, and sign up for an appointment through our online form.
There are so many unique stories, and you guys have collected so many of them. We're going to share a couple of them this morning, just to illustrate the breadth and depth of this festival and the breadth and depth of people who attended. I know that you were in Los Angeles as part of the first wave of the collection of stories, and you met with Ellen Orson Carisfort. Can you tell us a little bit about Ellen?
Yeah, I was really excited to interview Ellen when she had originally signed up and shared a little bit of information about her story. I thought it was really unique. Ellen was a very young person, only about 16 years old, I believe, and ended up working with the film crew at Woodstock And that turned into a lifelong career in film industry.
Yeah, you caught up with her in Hollywood. We have a clip, and I selected this portion of the clip. It's a little long. It's about 4 minutes, but it shows this arc of her being really excited and hearing about the festival. She was a film student. She was working on a documentary, but so she couldn't go to the festival, or so she thought. And it ends up with her being there and the kind of travels to get there. So let's listen to this clip. It's Ellen Orson Carisfort from the Woodstock, the Bethel Museum Woodstock Oral History Project.
So I'm working on this documentary about wilderness survival schools in Wyoming. And there's a buzz going around the office. There's a little buzz like, oh, maybe this is going to happen. Maybe this is going to happen. And it turns out that they were bidding and in negotiations with the producers of the festival to film it. And then one day, ta-da, we got the gig. Oh, they got the gig, and they're all going to go to the festival. I wanted to go to so bad. And it was like only a couple days before the festival. It was maybe Sunday. And all the principals of the company went flying up to Bethel to check it out and see what they were going to have to do. And the production manager was on the phone, Dale Bell, completely engrossed in trying to pull together a crew to shoot it, the film to shoot it upon, the gear, the trucks, the food, the support teams, and everything else. So this is all going on, and then one day Thelma Schoonmaker calls me from the site, and she says, we need all hands on deck. Can you get up here and, you know, work with us? And I said, well, I'll have to ask my mother, but yeah, okay, I'd love to. I'd really love to. So I went home that night and I asked my mother if I could go to this festival. And she'd been hearing about it. And she said, well, I don't know. You know, there's going to be a lot of people there and maybe, you know, a dangerous thing. And I said, well, I'm going to be with adult professionals. They're getting us hotels and, you know, I'm going to be chaperoned and taken care of, and I can get a ride with my friends who are leaving from New York. So she reluctantly said okay, but she was kind of, you know, she knew that it was a very important thing to do, and she was supportive of me in my efforts to put a career together for myself. So off I went to New York City with a little backpack and a bedroll, because I thought maybe I'll need a blanket, you know. Yeah. And I met up with my friends, and we drove all night, and we got into the thick traffic, and then we were creeping along, and then we were creeping along, and then we weren't creeping at all. And then we finally got there. They got me to my motel room, and I never saw them again that weekend. So the next morning, they assembled the whole crew, and they got us over to the site. All the crew members were staying there at this, it was called the Dude Ranch. And they got us over to the site and gathered the crew and said, okay, who can do what? We need this, we need this, we need this. And when they said, who can load magazines? Who can load film magazines? I put my hand up. I said, yeah, I can load a magazine. So they put me on the magazine loading team. But when I got to the area under the stage where they were doing all these quick changes of, you know, taking out the film that was shot and putting in fresh film and getting the thing back together again and lining it up, marking it with a number, all that ID stuff, I saw that these were different cameras than I was used to working with. They were very special new kind of camera called Eclairs. And I had only worked with Ariflexes before, so I told them, yeah, now, this isn't for me. You don't want me to be learning on the job. This is, you know, this is a critical job. So they sent me back to the coordinator, and they put me on with a cameraman named Ted Churchill, and I was to be his assistant. And he kind of looked at the coordinator and said, you're giving me a 16-year-old girl to be my assistant. What are you, crazy? What? But I assured him that I had filmed in riots and had been tear gassed, and I knew my way around and to stay out of, you know, stay out of the shot.
That was Ellen Orson Carisfort speaking to Julia Fell from the museum at Bethel Woods for the Woodstock Oral History Project.
telling what it was like as a 16-year-old film student shooting at the festival documentary Woodstock. You got to talk to her in Los Angeles, as we mentioned, Julia. She goes on to tell a little bit more about the cameras and syncing. It's a long introduction, but the arc of all of that, at the end of that, I heard you kind of sigh and take it all in. You're like, wow, this is kind of amazing, all these details that are within this story that you're telling me in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, sometimes you get an interview like that, and it's a big info dump, but it's blowing your mind at the same time, and you know there's so much more of the story to dig into. And that's exactly what happened during my interview with Ellen in Los Angeles last year. It was really incredible meeting her and hearing her story.
Well, and just in that 4 minutes, we got some of those details. I mean, first of all, she was 16 working on a documentary. And as she mentioned, she'd already been tear gassed in riots and was hoping to get to go, but she couldn't. She mentions a name, and I'm not sure if people picked up on it. She mentioned Thelma Schoonmaker. Now, if folks who know film and know Martin Scorsese, she is his longtime editor. They've collaborated for over 5 decades. In fact, they met as part of the editing team on the documentary about Woodstock. So that's a kind of interesting, cool detail that just popped up right there, too. She was working with those folks as part of this team, and then just having to ask her mom for permission and like thinking she might need a blanket. I mean, these kinds of details are really blow your mind a little bit.
Yeah, it's so funny sometimes the picture of what youth was like in the late 60s, that this girl could be working at a film studio and filming in riots, just needed to ask her mom permission to go to Woodstock. It's incredible the life that we get to have a little peek into.
Well, she also mentioned some of the things we kind of know about all the traffic, right? She met with her, drove up with her friends, and they crept along and crept along. And then she never saw them again that weekend because she went right to work. And then, got thrown into this as they were all sort of scrambling at the last minute, all hands on deck, as she says. And then discovers, oh, I don't know how to use this. I'll have to do something else. And then, she tags along with one of the cameramen as basically his assistant. Really fascinating. And, these stories, are they already up at the website that people can listen to? Or are you still editing?
So we're actually in year 4 of our 5-year collecting phase of the project. So that means we're putting the pedal to the metal on getting as many stories as we can. The next phase of the project, which will start in 2026, will be our archiving and databasing phase. And at that time, we're going to build a database to make the stories publicly accessible.
Oh, so you're giving us a little sneak peek here. Thank you for allowing us to present those. It's really, really is fascinating. You did mention the youth at that time. Further in the interview, you actually kind of asked about, wow, it's amazing that you were 16. And she's like, well, it was the youth movement. That was what was going on. Youth at that time, at that age, were all involved in this particular idea of peace and love.
Yeah, that's one of the really powerful messages that comes through in so many of our interviews. It was a really overwhelming thing. And myself, I was too young to be around at that time, but it's really inspiring.
Yeah. There are some other youth, maybe a little younger. We have a clip that we'll hear about some of the children who actually attended with their families and parents and friends. I want to take a quick break, though, and come back and we'll talk about that more with Julia Fell from the Museum at Bethel Woods and the Woodstock Oral History Initiative, collecting all the accounts of people who attended that festival. We'll have more right after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Celebrate Pride Weekend in the Sullivan Catskills, June 14th to 16th. Drag Me to the Catskills, a drag show event and celebration of LGBTQ+ pride and self-expression, with drag queen performances, dance parties, brunch, and more. Drag Me to the Catskills, June 14th to 16th. More information at dragmetothecatskills.com. It's going to be a fabulous weekend in the Catskills. Paid for by Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're speaking to Julia Fell from the Museum at Bethel Woods. Since 2020, the museum has been committed to collecting and preserving the stories of the people who knew Woodstock the best, the people that attended. You guys were awarded a major grant also to continue this oral history. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of getting that grant?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've been very fortunate in having actually received two federal grants over the last several years to support this work. The first was from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and this year we're working under a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And it's so significant to be able to work with these organizations, because we would not be able to do what we're doing in terms of travel and supporting our partners. We do work with consultants and partner organizations, and the grant has allowed us to really give back to the community and give back to our partners and consultants, as well as physically reach people who aren't able to come to us.
Yeah, I mentioned you guys are going to be at Bethel Woods this weekend to continue collection of stories. But as you said, you need to travel and go to where people are, because some people can't get to you. Can you talk a little bit about how important it is to go to where people are that may no longer be in the area?
Absolutely. When we were sort of conceiving of this oral history pop-up program as part of the larger initiative, our main philosophy was to meet people where they are. And that's something that I sort of developed by talking with students and interns. My parents are both educators, so that educational philosophy of meeting students where they are kind of really translated for me into this idea of meeting our storytellers where they are. And some people physically aren't able to come to our site, aren't comfortable with this technology to do an interview remotely, or are a little distrustful for one reason or another and really need that face-to-face interaction in order to feel comfortable sharing their story. So being able to go to where people are, regardless of where that may be in our country, is just so important, and it's been such a privilege to get to execute that. Mm-hmm.
When people think of Woodstock, there might be that narrative or stereotype that comes to mind of, you know, young hippies, you know, single people out there. But there were some families and kids that came as well. You guys have met with one of the children who actually attended Woodstock. His name is Vlad. Can you tell us a little bit about him and where you met up with him and his story?
Yeah, so Vlad was one of our participants in the pop-up program last year. We went to California, several different locations. We talked to Ellen, who you heard from earlier, in Los Angeles. We also traveled to Santa Barbara, California, where we met with Vlad and many others. And I didn't do Vlad's interview myself, but from what I was told after the fact, he shared this wonderful story of being a child, I think about 8 years old, who went to Woodstock with his mother, and how that experience really inspired him later in life. And he's now a musician. He's actually performed at Bethel Woods.
That's cool. Yeah. And we have a clip of that conversation from your colleague, Dr. Neil Hitch, there at the museum at Bethel Woods, who spoke to Vlad, who was 8 and attended the Woodstock Festival.
I don't know if you could say the word risk, but many other parents might think it would be hazardous to take an 8-year-old to a big festival, but it did turn out to be very peaceful, and I think she knew that it would be peaceful. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a peace and love festival, so she felt very confident that we would have a great time and that there would be no problems, and that's exactly how it turned out, except for the weather. So the rain is what caused the discomfort a little bit.
Did you see any other children or families, or have you ever heard of other children or families being there?
Well, I've heard about it, but I don't remember exactly seeing the children, other children while I was there. Mm. I don't remember that part. But of course, in the film, you could see all the children there.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a picture of yourself or your mother?
There was one photo that I did see a few years back. It was a stage shot of when Richie Havens was on the stage, and it was taken from behind him. And I remember exactly where we were sitting. We were sitting to the left of him as we're looking at the stage. So that's where I could swear I see my face in there, but the resolution wasn't high enough of the photo that I saw. So perhaps one day I can see a very high-res image of that and I can confirm it's me, but I'm pretty sure that's me in that audience shot.
That was an 8-year-old attendee at Woodstock, Vlad, who spoke to the folks from the museum at Bethel Woods. Dr. Neil Hitch, you heard there from the museum interviewing him for their oral history project. We're talking to his colleague Julia Fell from the museum at Bethel Woods this morning about that project. They're moving into their second phase of collection after beginning in 2020. You know, amazing to hear that person with his memory of being so young and being at the event.
Yeah, it's always incredible when we get to meet somebody with a slightly different perspective, including people who are much younger, which is a bit unusual. But meeting Vlad was really, really interesting. And I know there are other people out there, particularly maybe local people who were younger children at the time who had a different perspective on the festival. And we'd be very interested in speaking with anyone who has those sort of stories to share at our pop-up this weekend.
This weekend at the museum at Bethel Woods, there in Bethel at the site of the original Woodstock concert. There's more information about how to become involved at BethelWoodsCenter.org. Julia, before we go, you know, you mentioned you're an educator. This project has been close to you for the last few years. What does it mean to you to hear these stories of people at such a young age culminating in Bethel for this amazing event?
It's hard to put into words, actually. I've interviewed hundreds of people at this point, and I always like to end my interviews with a question about what sort of message they would like to pass on to future generations. And for me, that's really what it's all about. It's about preserving these stories for us to benefit from in the future. I think I've gotten sort of the sneak peek of that as the interviewer. I've gotten to hear the wisdom of all these people who are generations above me. And I just can't wait for other people my age and younger to also get that benefit when the interviews become public.
How does that influence you in terms of when you're thinking about how to make them public and how they're going to be exhibited, you know, making sure that those stories and those voices are preserved? How is that sort of guiding you guys and how you're getting that out there eventually for the public?
We want to make it as full access as possible. So we, of course, do have plans to, in the future, use clips and quotes from the oral histories in exhibits and programs. But the kind of holy grail that I really hope comes to fruition is this database where every single story that we have collected with a full transcript will be available and keyword searchable. So if some young person out there is, you know, interested in trying to figure themselves out, they can search for any number of topics related to Woodstock or the 1960s and find somebody who was their age at that time, who was going through some of these really interesting or even difficult things, and hopefully be able to take something from that.
So your line of work is education and, you know, curator at a museum, but it sounds like it's a lot of work. Is it, or is that just par for the course in your field?
It is a full-time job. Yeah. It's the traveling is such a privilege, and it makes it a little bit unusual. It's not always just a 9-to-5, but it's really the experience of a lifetime, and I couldn't be happier to be doing what I'm doing.
So such a great effort to collect and preserve these stories from the people who attended Woodstock. Again, there is an upcoming place to hear your story, tell your story at Bethel Woods, June 14th to 16th, this weekend at the Museum at Bethel Woods. And then you guys are going to Ohio later this summer, else throughout New York, and then back in the January wintertime in Florida. Smartly scheduled, I will say.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're on a roll with the traveling, and we don't plan to stop anytime soon. We're really excited for what's coming next.
All right. And when does this phase wrap up, and when do you expect that you will have things for the public? Is that coming in the next year or so, or is it longer?
So we're working in our collection phase through the end of 2025, and then we'll start with the archiving and databasing in 2026. Not really sure exactly when the database will be up and running. It might take a year or two after we start that to really get it ready for the public, but we're hoping just as soon as possible to get that ready.
All right. Julia Fell from the Museum at Bethel Woods, talking to us about the Woodstock Oral History Project. More information at BethelWoodsCenter.org. Julia, thank you so much, and good luck this weekend.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, we'll take a break. And when we come back, neuroscience and the arts, an evening of science talks and performances at Farm Arts Collective. We'll get more information after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
I'm Matt Hurtado. Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day, and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're with Radio Catskill. This Saturday, Farm Arts Collective presents an evening of science talks and performances on mental health, neuroscience, and innovative treatment. It's kicking off their 2024 season in their new Agriculture Center on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. The evening intersects innovative scientists with innovative artists in an evening of call and response between the two disciplines. Our own science guy, Joe Johnson, got to hear more about it. I spoke to Tanis Kowalczyk, Artistic Director of Farm Arts Collective, and Dr. Allison Waters, Neuroscientist and Director of the Waters Lab at Mount Sinai.
Allison, Tanis, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Joe.
I think my obvious first question has to be, but there doesn't seem to be an obvious connection between neurotechnology and performance art. How did this idea come about?
Do you want to take this, Allison?
Well, gosh, Tanis and I have now worked together on several productions that bring the two together. So yeah, we have a little bit of experience working in this space together.
But what was the initial connection there, though? That's really what's the part of this that's really fascinating to me.
Well, I think if we go back many, many years ago, I was doing theater first in Canada and then moved my practice to New York City. And Allison and I were in the same theater company. We were in the same company called NACL Theater, which is a company that's based here in Sullivan County.
Mm-hmm. I drive by it all the time.
Yeah. And so we were initial members of that company and made some plays together. And then Allison Waters went off to study science and to eventually get her PhD in neuroscience research. And so there was a project that I wanted to work on after having experienced a brain injury, a stroke, where I contacted Allison and said, hey, this is a crazy thing just happened to me, and I think I want to make a play about it. Will you be in my play and be my, my science consult? And ultimately, Allison became pretty heavily involved in the production, and that was our first union together, a piece called Struck, where we brought neuroscience and ideas of neuroscience and the brain and the experience of having a stroke together with performance art.
That's quite a connection.
And it turned out that the medium of theater is, it's a place where we get to explore human creaturehood, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a great place where we get to use metaphor and be playful and be funny, and we can really explore some of these themes, including mental illness, that that we talk about with the tools of science in a very different way, but we're still talking about the same human experience, right?
Allison, could you define exactly for us what neurotechnology is?
Sure. When I say neurotechnology, I'm referring to all of the emerging ways that we're beginning to treat mental illness by moving directly into the brain. So a direct-to-brain intervention. In our case, it's usually electrical neuromodulation, where we're either using a neurosurgical technique to go in and implant a device in the brain that will then interact with neural circuits, or in other cases, you might be interacting with the brain from the outside of the skull using something like ultrasound or therapeutic pulses from the outside of the skull. But I would include psychedelics in that category as well, as a matter of fact. I think of psychedelic science also as a direct brain intervention or a form of neuromodulation and neurotechnology, if you will.
I saw that one of the performances is going to involve ketamine.
That's right.
So I believe that all the neuroscientists that are involved in this project work with you at the Waters Lab at Mount Sinai Hospital. Who's going to be speaking to us that evening?
Oh, you'll hear from one of our neurosurgeons, Dr. Ted Panoff, and you'll hear from two students who are mid-career, becoming junior investigators. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to do this work with Pharma Arts Collective, and that's to give these early career scientists an opportunity to talk about their work and see their work from a different perspective, interacting with artists and the public. Because, you know, it takes like 15, 20 years to train to be a scientist. And I have discovered that when students learn how to talk about their work at really early stages of their career development, it can have a pretty profound impact on their ability to formulate a lifelong research mission of their own. So there's some reciprocity here. We're trying to bring some cutting edge ideas to the public, but there's reciprocity. You know, we want to learn what's important and what's concerning and what people find urgent.
So I understand that the performance will be four short TED style talks, each of which will be followed by a performance piece inspired by the talk. Talk to me about that process.
The artists that are going to be participating in this presentation have all heard about the different conversations and the TED-style talks that are going to be presented at the event. And I think they all gravitated towards something, you know, captured their imagination as artists. And so we paired artists with scientists, and they've had an opportunity to have a conversation and learn about what each other's doing. And so there will be these presentations that are these, it's like a call and response. The scientist gives a presentation, talks about an idea, and then the artist responds in whatever way they do and with whatever discipline that they work in. So we've got a jazz guitarist, we've got a vocal improviser and musician and composer. We've got a theater director who's going to be using a lot of slide and imagery and costume. We have a movement artist, and it's like a really wonderful group of people. We have a storyteller. So we've got Aaron Dudley, who's our movement artist, Jonathan Charles Fox, he was an actor, storyteller, and writer, Kazri Jackson, a composer and jazz improviser, Menel Menavi, who's our interdisciplinary theater director, Doug Rogers, the Farm Arts Collective composer and actor, and Will Selenrad, who is a New York City-based jazz guitarist and has a home up here. And so it's going to be a true cabaret. It's going to be a true interdisciplinary cabaret of artistic disciplines with science. And the conversation, too, will really talk about mental health, as Allison said. I mean, they're working on depression, and that's something that affects every single person who walks into this room on Saturday night. We have either felt and then suffered it or know someone who does. It's guaranteed going to connect to every single person who walks in the door at the new Farm Arts Collective Agricultural Center, which we just opened last Sunday. So I'm excited that people get to come and see the building as well. But it's going to really connect, I think, to our audiences and to our community.
Is this your first production in the new facility?
Yes.
Oh.
I know.
What an honor. What an honor.
The Science Cabaret.
Well, I think it's also perfect, Allison, because you and I were doing theater together the first time in New York City. We were like doing that together for the first time, and now here we are at the new space.
It does feel full circle, but it also feels like a really honest response to what you are building there on Willowisp Farm Tennis. Joe, earlier you had asked us about the relationship between neurotech and farming, and I'm always surprised by that question too, because in particular neurotech that's addressing mental illness. I mean, Tennis is building a cultural center there where people can come together and talk about real issues, grapple with real issues together, and try to do it in a way that is nurturing new ideas and new possibilities. So I feel like it's fitting that we kick off her season this year by, I don't know, I think doing an event that's exquisitely relatable. I mean, we're quite on the frontier here with these emerging neurotechnologies. I'll admit that. So it's just fascinating.
This is pretty cutting-edge science and medicine, and to some, it would be controversial. Do you explore the idea of the controversy of some of this in the performance at all?
I can see that is going to be a part of the dialogue between the scientists and the artists. And that's another reason why I like the cabaret atmosphere, because it's a little bit subversive. When we make it a cabaret atmosphere, we can be a little bit more playful with some of these more scary ideas. Joe, I suspect that in a short amount of time, we will be hacking our brains. The technologies are emerging in this way, and we're right on the frontier of it. So we need to be talking about it as a community and a culture. We need to be building the language that will ultimately direct and constrain how these technologies emerge and become accessible.
I think we all need to be part of that conversation.
Yes, and I also think it's an interesting opportunity to allow an artist to respond, because they're not going to it's not going to come from a necessarily a linear or literal or verbal place. It's going to come from another kind of location in the body or the mind and spirit, which is what art does ultimately. And it will be a really interesting response to witness. And then we can all, of course, have the conversation. We're going to have some good food at the event, as we always do at Farm Arts Collective. And it'll just be an opportunity for great conversation and just a really interesting interdisciplinary night all around.
Tanis, are there any other areas of science or medicine that you'd like to explore through performance?
I'm doing a lot of scientific exploration right now, working on a project called Dream on the Farm. We are building one play every year for 10 years about climate change. And every year, it's a different story, but we're talking about climate change in different ways. And, I've been throughout this whole process, in collaboration with a NASA climate scientist named Elaine Matthews, and she has always been vetting our information, giving us guidance in what to read, what to research. So climate change is my other science that I'm engaged in through art and community, and community activism, really, because the plays we're making are created and performed by local ensemble and local people.
So when and where will the performance happen?
The Dream on the Farm performance?
No, the neurotechnology performance this weekend. I just wanted to let people know where they can buy tickets and how they can get there.
Okay, so Science Cabaret is going to be this Saturday, June 15th, starting at 7 p.m. I think we'll open the doors around 6:30, but it's not going to start until 7, so... And we are located at Willowisp Organic Farm, which is in Damascus, PA. If you go across the Calicoon Bridge, if you're coming from the New York side, or if you come down the route, oh, I can never remember, 371, past Damascus School and turn left on River Road. You'll find us because we're right on the river. We're on River Road. We have a beautiful location on Willow Wisp Organic Farm. And people can get their tickets. You can go online to farmartscollective.org, or you can get your tickets at the door if you want to make a last-minute decision. It's all good.
Ellison and Tanis, thank you so much for joining me today. This is a really interesting performance, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be attending.
Awesome. Oh, I look forward to meeting you.
That's our own science guy, Joe Johnson, speaking to Tanis Kowalczyk, Artistic Director of Farm Arts Collective, and Dr. Allison Waters, Neuroscientist and Director of the Waters Lab at Mount Sinai. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the artistic effort to save the Skinner's Falls Bridge. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radio Lab.
40 million infected people is a plague, and nobody acts as it is.
When your government seems indifferent to your pain and suffering.
What's the right way to protest? Can a protest actually hurt the movement that you're protesting for?
The goal is to say this is wrong.
I just began to sob convulsively.
Express your desperation.
Turn your grief into rage.
That's on the next Radio Lab. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The 45-day public comment period on the Skinner's Falls Bridge draft Pell study recently ended on May 26th, and a summary report will be issued by late summer to guide decision-making over the bridge's future. Alternatives are to preserve the existing bridge through traditional rehabilitation, repair, tear it down and build a new structure, replace, or eliminate the crossing entirely, remove. Once the option is determined and a funding source is identified, it could take 2 years to obtain permits and environmental clearances for any type of construction to begin, and the bridge has been closed since 2019. The National Park Service cites the 467-foot-long ornamental steel bridge with a single-lane wooden plank deck as vital to contributing cultural element to the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River's outstandingly remarkable values that qualified it for placement on the National Register of Historic Places. In an effort to celebrate and save the Skinner's Falls Bridge, Zane Gray Planair is inviting artists, photographers, and families and friends for a day of creative connections. Joining us now is the artist and founder of Zane Gray Planair, Karen Menigan. Karen, good morning.
Hi there, Tim. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for being here. Let's talk a little bit about this event, the Creative Connections event. How did it come about? And again, you're trying to, you know, make people aware about saving the Skinner's Falls Bridge.
Yes, it's been an interesting path. We were first at as a group with an outing at Skinner's Falls Bridge just after the closing 5 years ago. We partnered with the Damascus Citizens for Sustainability at that time and kind of co-authored that event. Again, an artistic effort to shine a light, the beautiful icon and marvel, to be honest, of engineering at that time, that is the Skinner's Falls Bridge. It's a thing of beauty. As you mentioned, it culturally connects two communities, two river communities that sadly have been disconnected for 5 years. So we thought with the recent comment period, coming to a head here, that it would be wonderful to revisit and go back to the property. So we approached the owners, again, Steve and Jane Urcha, about hosting an event, and they have backed us, welcomed us to have an expanded event this time. It's going to be all day. We've opened it up to more than just painters because we consider it a creative activity for all in the community. And we've invited photographers, families, and friends, and we have activities for kids. It's so important to teach the kids about the beautiful history that we have here. So we're very pleased with the support by Steve and Jane to have us there for the day.
Now, I want to make sure I get this right. Plein air painting is about leaving the four walls of your studio or the space where you paint inside and going out into the landscape, right?
Absolutely. The practice of plein air started hundreds of years ago, and it basically means al fresco for you diners out there. It's an immersion in the outdoors to react to the light and atmosphere, as well as the various locations. And in our immediate vicinity, a real obvious group was the Hudson Valley School of Painters, who likewise were very concerned about conservation and about industrialization of certain areas. So they, you know, like our group, we adopted those same goals to celebrate what we have, you know, recognize these same efforts to preserve natural beauty and architecture.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about that. You mentioned the Hudson River School, and you mentioned your mission of historic preservation. Can you talk a little bit about how landscape painters came to be known as conservationists? It's not just about painting a pretty scene. It's about, you know, showing and conserving this bucolic area.
Absolutely. There was, in the mid-1800s, many art colonies were formed in various parts of the country. I'll talk about the Northeast, who came to upstate regions, the Adirondacks, the Catskills, quite famously, were the roost of the Hudson River School painters, and many, many noted painters lived and worked in the area. Olana, Frederick Church is one. Thomas Cole is another, and we really are an extension of the Hudson River Valley in our nook of the Catskills here. I mean, we really are considered a part of that movement.
And Zane Grey, also your namesake, as part of that.
Absolutely. I feel akin to Zane, and for years I passed his home. I've been summering and have become a full-time resident about 6 years ago, but I went to the Park Service to learn more, of course, about the property over time, but did approach them about hosting our first plein air event on the property and knew that for Zane, that property there had significant interest for he and his family as a source of creativity. It was their base on the Upper Delaware. He was a well-known conservationist and champion of the environment, which really is exemplified in his many adventure books that he's very well-known for. He really, to be honest, published more than Hemingway. I mean, he is a Hemingway-esque character, you know, robust and the consummate outdoorsman who loves fishing. And it's amazing that he and Dolly are actually buried just down the road from the house. They came back to eternally roost in Lackawaxing because that was their spiritual and creative home.
I mentioned in the introduction that the summary report for the Skinner's Falls Bridge from PennDOT is due later this summer, a guide to some decision-making over the bridge's future. There are a few alternatives to repair, replace, or remove that bridge. You have said that you've learned from listening to interviews with Ed Wellesley historian and a local resident about the bridge, about your decisions about what should happen and why you're doing this event. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have to say, being involved there, knowing what's at stake, I love to do a little dig a little deeper into some research on the history of the bridge and the history of logging in the area. The location dates back to colonial times with the Skinner family. They're a multi-generational family, right? And Daniel was the rafter, celebrated rafter, who worked there. And because of that raft at that location, it was thought that regular passage would be beneficial to the area. So the bridge was built after that Milton Skinner, and where we will be painting at the Milton Skinner House. Was with the American Bridge Company and built the bridge there, which was revolutionary for its time. The iron spans and trusses. It was, for its time, really an engineering marvel. And this same bridge company went on years later to build the Verrazano Bridge. So, you know, one thing leads to another. All of the engineering features and testing and design leads from one project to another. So in my opinion, not only is it important to preserve, you know, architecturally and as an engineering feat, it is important, as we all know, to connect the two river communities. It's symbolic of the connection there and of the two communities culturally and historically. And as I say, this new discovery and listening to Ed's wonderful interviews by Rosie Starr, which we have linked on our website. There's a nice short snippet that I encourage people to come there and listen to Ed's more inclusive reminiscences of the history of the area. It's fascinating. It really brings it all together for me.
All right, let's remind folks where they can get more information about the event that's happening this Saturday, Creative Connection, the community art event at the Skinner's Falls Milanville Bridge from 10 to 4.
Okay, yes, please, everyone, join us. If not for this, for other events. We do have limited space to accommodate cars, but go to our website, if you will. We're at zanegrayplenair.com. We have links there for you to register, to sign up for other workshops we have in the area, one coming up at the Tustin Heritage Community Garden, where we'll be examining and drawing pollinators, and we have another event at the Old Stone House in Hasbrook, doing some landscape sketching as well. So we've got a lot of wonderful programs lined up. Join us. Our links are on our homepage on our website.
All right. Karen Menigan, the artist and founder of the Zane Gray Plein Air Group. Again, there's more information at the website, zanegrayplenair.com. And also on your Facebook page. Karen, thank you so much, and have a good Saturday outside in the landscape, drawing and creating.
Tim, thank you so much. The weather looks great.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, if you're worried about the divides in our country and are wondering about what you can do to be part of the solution, Radio Catskill invites you to take part in One Small Step from StoryCorps, which pairs strangers with different beliefs for a conversation, not about politics, but about your lives. Help bring our community together one conversation at a time. You can find out more, fill out the questionnaire to be matched at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. and from the Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org, and listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.